Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, Egypt just finished its first round of elections since the uprising earlier this year by democratic activists. So why aren't the activists overjoyed? We'll talk about the state of democracy in Egypt and the way U.S. corporate media are covering it with independent journalist and Democracy Now! Cairo correspondent Sharif Abdelkaddous. Also on the program, U.S. elite media provided cover for the military during the 2004 invasion of Fallujah, dismissing and downplaying reports of civilian deaths in the besieged Iraqi city. Our guest says the failure to confront what happened in Fallujah may still be having life or death effects as media ignore present-day concerns of a health crisis there that may be related to the use of chemical weapons. Hannah Gurman is a columnist for Foreign Policy in Focus, as well as assistant professor at New York University's Gallatin School. She'll join us to talk about the under-examined story of Fallujah. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a quick look back at the week's press.
The presidential campaign season has been filled with entertaining and embarrassing gaffes. Rick Perry not knowing the voting age, Herman Cain fumbling around on Libya, Mitt Romney praising a murderous dictatorship. Wait, what? In the November 22nd debate, Romney said this about Pakistan. Quote, "We don't want to just pull up stakes and get out of town after the enormous output we've just made for the region. Look at Indonesia in the 60s. We helped them move towards modernity." Close quote. The statement was hardly noticed by corporate media, but to people paying attention, Romney seemed to be praising the reign of Indonesian dictator Suharto, who took power in the mid-1960s and murdered at least a half a million Indonesians in his regime's anti-communist campaigns. The progressive's Matt Rothschild called Romney's answer the most outrageous comment of the whole debate, adding that, quote, "a little follow-up from Wolf Blitzer would have been nice there," close quote. One of the only other journalists to catch this was Dan Murphy of the Christian Science Monitor, who spent a decade reporting from Indonesia. As Murphy wrote, the 1960s saw, quote, "the systematic destruction of Indonesia's nascent democratic institutions and political parties, state repression of opponents with torture, targeted killings and long jail terms, and a military-backed dictatorship that persisted until a popular uprising in 1998 pushed Suharto finally from power," close quote. The first sentence in Murphy's piece was, "I don't generally write about U.S. politics." Indeed, and hundreds of journalists who spend every day writing about U.S. politics didn't see anything newsworthy in Romney's shout-out to a bloody dictatorship.
It's hard to know exactly what to make of the New York Times' November 29th piece on Republican candidate Newt Gingrich as the smartest candidate in the room. Reporter Tripp Gabriel seems to mean it when he writes, quote, "In an election season rife with factual misstatements, deliberate and otherwise, Mr. Gingrich sometimes seems to stand out for exhibiting an excess of knowledge," close quote. Though who knows what an excess of knowledge might be, or whether he's suggesting Gingrich is smart or just smarter than, say, Michelle Bachmann. The piece includes some critics of Gingrich's credentials as an historian, but it seems sincere in concluding that, quote, "fellow historians are generally pleased that Mr. Gingrich brings history into the national conversation, even if some dispute his insights," close quote. But then no fellow historians are found to respond to Gingrich's claim that the U.S. spends less on its military as a percentage of GDP than at any time since Pearl Harbor, for example, or his insight that the stimulus bill was anti-Christian legislation that would stop church groups from holding meetings in public schools.
International efforts to ban cluster bombs recently broke down. Here's how the New York Times reported it on November 26th. Quote, "despite last-minute attempts to broker a compromise, American-led efforts to conclude an international treaty restricting use of cluster munitions collapsed on Friday in the face of opposition from countries that said it did not address their humanitarian concerns and would undermine existing international law," close quote. The American-led effort, the Times said, quote, "reflected the increasing stigmatization of a weapon recognized as causing unacceptable harm to civilians and seen as having lasting effects on development for decades after conflicts have ended," close quote. So wait, who opposes banning cluster bombs? It takes work to extract this from the Times account, but it's the U.S. The U.S. favors restricting rather than banning. While those for banning include dozens of countries, the Red Cross, and UN agencies. They want the outright ban outlined by a 2008 Oslo conference and say the U.S. proposed restrictions would make little difference. Contrast the Times' murkiness with the Reuters report from November 25th, which began, quote, a U.S.-led push to regulate rather than ban cluster munitions failed Friday after 50 countries objected, following humanitarian campaigners' claims that anything less than an outright ban would be an unprecedented reversal of human rights law, close quote. Seems straightforward enough.
Back in March, we wondered when U.S. corporate news outlets would find U.S.-NATO killing of Afghan children newsworthy. 9 children were killed in an airstrike March 1st, generating 2 network news stories and 2 brief mentions on the PBS NewsHour. On November 25th, the New York Times reported on page 12 that 6 children were killed in one attack in southern Afghanistan on November 23rd. The news was, as far as we could tell, not reported on ABC, CBS, NBC, or the NewsHour, though there were several pieces about U.S. soldiers eating Thanksgiving dinners. A subsequent New York Times editorial on the killing of 24 Pakistani soldiers by NATO airstrikes gave indication of just what priority Afghan kids might be given. Of the 24 Pakistani soldiers, the paper said, quote, we regret those deaths, as we do those of all American, NATO, and Afghan troops and Pakistani and Afghan civilians killed by extremists, close quote. Civilians not killed by what the paper defines as extremists don't even make the list. As Salon columnist Glenn Greenwald observed, Americans have been trained simply to accept these incidents as though they carry no meaning. Quote, it's acceptable to make arguments that American wars should end because they're costing too much money or American lives or otherwise harming American strategic interests. But piles of corpses of innocent children are something only the shrill, shallow, and unserious pacifists point to as though they have any meaning in terms of what should be done. Close quote.
And finally, a number of people noticed that while its international editions carried a cover story about the Egyptian uprising, the U.S. version of Time Magazine's December 5th issue featured a cartoon illustrating the lead story, Why Anxiety is Good for You. We also noticed something else. The article, which talks about the science of stress and the drugs that are available to help take the edge off, is surrounded by ads for pharmaceutical and health companies. How convenient for readers to learn about the possible benefits of antidepressants on acute anxiety and then see a full-page ad for an antidepressant. There are also ads for eye treatments, pain relievers, and psoriasis drugs clustered around the story about health, anxiety, and, well, drugs. It's true news magazines carry pharmaceutical ads all the time. It's also true that Time is the magazine that once explained that, no, they wouldn't run a story about air pollution in a feature on the environment because Ford Motor Company is a big sponsor and, quote, we don't run airline ads next to stories about airline crashes, close quote. In other words, don't hold your breath for a Time cover story about the downside of such drugs, even in the international edition.
Thanks, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
Egypt is just finishing the first round of a series of elections that will end in January. The elections would not be happening if not for the pro-democracy uprising that happened early this year, an uprising that is heralded as the jewel in the crown of the so-called Arab Spring. So why are many Egyptian democracy activists expressing discouragement at the state of things in their country? Sharif Abdelkaddous is an independent journalist and Democracy Now! Correspondent. He joins us now from Cairo. Welcome back to Counterspin, Sharif Abdelkaddous.
Thank you for having me again, Steve.
Well, Sharif, in a new piece in The Nation, you wrote about some of this discouragement, that it reflects the broader complexities of Egypt's first post-revolutionary elections, an eagerness to participate in the democratic process soured by the realities of a deeply flawed transition plan and the heavy yoke of military rule. So are you suggesting that the revolution has been arrested, that its progress has been stopped?
No, I mean, the revolution is still very much going on. All revolutions in history have taken years to complete. What's happened right now with this election, essentially, is that it appears, although we're waiting for official election results to come out, that the Muslim Brotherhood has won a significant portion. So have the Salafi movements, which is a more extreme Islamist movement, and a small portion by the liberal bloc. Many media pundits have celebrated this election as a glorious path and a step towards democracy in Egypt. However, I think it's very important for people to understand what exactly the powers that this parliament will be mandated to have. Right now, we're still ruled by the Supreme Council of Armed Forces, which is the military council that took power after Mubarak was forced out of office on February 11th, following the 18-day uprising that centered in Tahrir Square. That military council is still in charge of the country. Once this parliament convenes in March, the military council will be the one to appoint the prime minister. The military council will be the one to appoint all ministers, not the parliament. The military council, it's still unclear exactly what the mandate of the parliament is. The primary goal of it is to write the next constitution, this post-revolutionary constitution, but under proposed guidelines that the military council proposed in October, out of a 100-member body to write the constitution, the military would pick 80 of its members, and the parliament would only pick 20. The military also pushed to include items that would bring it above and away from any kind of civilian oversight. The military budget would appear as a one-line item in the budget, and the parliament could not oversee it. So these are very serious concerns, and what many of the young revolutionaries here who took to the streets on January 25th to start this uprising and have been doing so over the last 9 months, are very concerned that while the political elite in this country, the Muslim Brotherhood, liberal groups, other political parties, fight over crumbs given to them by the military council, the real fight is against the army, the most important institution in Egypt for the last 60 years.
So their call, the democracy activist call, is not necessarily for elections, at least not right now. It's really for removing military power.
Well, I mean, as we saw in the past 10 days, there was a new uprising that really was began on November 19th, sparked by clashes that erupted when police forces stormed Tahrir Square and violently broke up a small sit-in. And protesters descended on Tahrir in solidarity, as they have done in the past. This quickly escalated in some of the fiercest street battles that we've witnessed in Egypt since January 25th. It lasted for five straight days, almost 120 continuous hours. There was an astonishing amount of tear gas fired. There was rubber bullets. There was live ammunition. All the while, the army could have stepped in and stopped this, but they didn't. But this protest grew to some of the largest protests in Tahrir since January 25th, and the call was very, very clear, an end to military rule. And so I think many of the young revolutionaries here have kept that focus and are continuing to do that as elections go forward.
Well, I'm looking at the Times reporting on the election the day after the election, and I'm afraid in looking at U.S. media in general that a lot of Americans would look at this first round of elections and say, isn't this what the activist wanted? What's missing is a lot of the context that I think you've just added about how little the elections will mean in the writing of a constitution, how powerful the military is. Do you think they're missing a lot of the story here?
Well, I think a lot of times, like you say, the overall context is missing. Another example, of course, is during these clashes, most of this tear gas that was fired, which really wounded many, many, many people. 3,000 people were wounded. Most of it was being overcome by tear gas. A number of people died of asphyxiation as being exposed to tear gas. This tear gas came from the United States, most of it from a company called Combined Systems that's based in Pennsylvania. And there really wasn't a lot of coverage that I saw in the U.S. press pointing to that fact, although many people in Tahrir were very, very aware of it. What's also very significant over these last 9 months is what the military council has been doing. They have continued to clamp down on the media here in Egypt. They have arrested and interrogated journalists. They have stormed TV stations. They have censored newspapers. They have put 12,000 people on military trial, 12,000 civilians. That's more civilians than in the total 30 years of Mubarak's rule. So they have acted very much in the same way as the previous dictatorship. And this is what people continue to fight for. But the revolution has been continuing. There's been a very active labor movement that has continued in strikes that have reached all sectors of the labor movement, from education to port workers to factory workers. And I think some people here are still very encouraged that the revolutionary call for bread freedom and social justice will be achieved.
Some of the other context that's missing from U.S. reporting is how the U.S. has really been furiously trying to preserve its interest in Egypt by continuing to support the violent and anti-democratic Egyptian military, for instance. I wonder if you could comment, is the U.S. role in post-uprising Egypt better known in Egypt than it is here in the United States?
Well, people here are very politically aware and very aware that the U.S. government funds the Egyptian military to the tune of $1.3 billion a year, without which the military would be much weakened and not as potent a force.
And it's continued to do this since the uprising.
Absolutely. It has continued the funding. The commander of the CENTCOM commander, James Mattis, has met at least three times with Field Marshal Hussein Tantawi, who's the head of the military council here and the de facto ruler of the country. Their ties have stayed strong despite these continuing abuses that have happened over these last few months, and these moves to frankly entrench themselves in power and to be above any kind of civilian oversight, which will hinder any real move towards freedom and democracy here in Egypt. That's clearly something that I think that everyone here is aware of. And the U.S. press, it is mentioned sometimes, but I think the point isn't pressed home strong enough.
Well, we just have a little while left, but I wonder if you could comment on why the U.S. corporate media don't present this context that, say, you and your Democracy Now! Colleagues seem to be able to report.
Well, I think this is a problem that's endemic to a lot of the corporate media, is that they don't stray too far out of the line of what those in power say. So their line of the political spectrum ranges from Democrat to Republican, whereas most of us in the independent media go beyond that spectrum to what people on the ground are saying, people at the target end of policy, people who don't regularly have a voice in the corporate media. So I think that's just another example of how the corporate media kind of pose the line and doesn't challenge those in power, when in fact independent media, that's the very basis for their reporting.
We've been speaking with independent journalist and Democracy Now! Correspondent Sharif Abdel Kaddous. You can read Sharif's latest on Egypt, Turnout High in Egypt's Elections, But Questions About Transition Remain, at thenation.com. Thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin, Sharif Abdel Kaddous.
Thank you very much for having me.
U.S. troops' violent and destructive invasion of the Iraqi city of Fallujah in 2004 was hard to fit into the official storyline of a war that was succeeding. But some corporate media did their part, dismissing reports of civilian deaths as unreliable, for example, while failing to seek theoretically more authoritative information. The New York Times dismissed charges of the use of chemical weapons in Fallujah right up until the Pentagon was forced to admit it. And a CNN host actually berated the head of Al Jazeera, one of the only news outlets reporting Fallujah from the inside, for covering civilian casualties, saying, with all due respect, the behavior of insurgents was the bigger story. Now Fallujah faces, among other problems, a health crisis, and it's important to know how much that has to do with the effects of the invasion. But will U.S. reporters even ask the questions? Hannah Gurman is assistant professor at New York University's Gallatin School and a columnist for Foreign Policy in Focus. Her recent article, The Underexamined Story of Fallujah, appeared on their website and elsewhere. She joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Hannah Gurman.
Thank you.
Well, before we talk about the reality of Fallujah today, it seems relevant to note that the city has a particular role in the story of the counterinsurgency in Iraq, doesn't it? It's not seen or presented by official Washington as a nightmarish failure.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Well, initially, the counterinsurgency in Anbar province was not going well And counterinsurgency in Fallujah in particular was a disaster. But by the time the sort of progress narrative of counterinsurgency began to be spun by David Petraeus and others, Fallujah became a linchpin in the story that eventually became known as the Anbar Awakening. So you have military press conferences and reports in which, despite the fact that the city was really shattered in terms of infrastructure and unemployment, being spun as a linchpin in the counterinsurgency success.
Well, what is the nature of the health crisis today in Fallujah, and what's the state of research into it?
It's a good question, and we don't really have all of the answers. At this point, we do know reports have come out from Fallujah Hospital in particular, in which we have reports of an alarming rise, in particular, of birth defects and of a rise in site-specific cancers. So Fallujah General Hospital reports, for example, in September 2009, 170 babies born, 24% of which died in the first week, and 75% of those were deformed. That compared to August 2002, where they reported 530 babies born, only 6 deaths and 1 deformity. This is all, to some extent, anecdotal, right? These are the reports that the hospital has, so it's an alarming rise, but there has been a dearth of scientific evidence to back that up, evidence that might give some sense of formal justice to the people of Fallujah. Christopher Busby, who is an epidemiologist and toxicologist at the University of Ulster in the UK, has done some studies, but they're not conclusive. And so one of the problems is that we have a sort of under-examined problem that we know is there, but that hasn't gotten enough attention either in the scientific community or in the media.
I take it that the U.S., the Defense Department, denies the existence of the health crisis, or at minimum is not doing its own investigation?
Yes, that's true. There have been various NGOs and groups of doctors, both from Iraq and from the UK, who have petitioned the UN to do further investigation. And the US has dismissed these requests, regarding them as anecdotal and inconclusive. So until there is more quote unquote evidence to back up the suspicions that perhaps US weaponry is responsible for this rise in birth defects and cancer, the U.S. isn't taking it seriously.
And of course, yes, there's no story there from journalist perspective. Well, in response to FAIR complaints about the dismissal of estimates of civilian deaths in the April 2004 attack, the New York Times ombud Clark Hoyt wrote, quote, "Trying to establish the precise numbers killed and how they died is an important story, but it can't be told authoritatively by best guesses based on some mix of unspecified news reports and personal observation," close quote. Well, of course, at the same time, the Times and others were dismissing, for example, the Lancet study as being widely criticized, as being controversial, precisely because the conclusions of that study of excess deaths from the Iraq invasion conflicted with the news reports and the personal observations of the journalists and the officials that they rely on. And this seems to be a preferred journalistic method for dealing with some of these ugly realities. You say you can't say anything without reliable data, but then no data is ever reliable enough.
Right, that's true. So it's one thing for epidemiologists and toxicologists to remark that these studies are inconclusive, that maybe, in a sense, they should be regarded as prompts for further investigation. But it's another thing for a media whose bar is to call attention to a problem, not to necessarily assess the science, but to show that anecdotally there is a problem and that there should be more investment in such further scientific investigation, and also in pressuring both the state of Iraq and the United States and the UK into having to account for what it did in Iraq.
Yeah, and it's very hard to take seriously the idea that this is some extra caution being exhibited by journalists when we know that they speculate on all kinds of things all the time.
Yeah, I think that's true. It would be one thing if the U.S. media in particular were reporting on the story but citing aspects to be cautious about. Mm-hmm. But instead, I think that we have a narrative about the winding down of the Iraq War, and this story doesn't fit into that narrative, and that's one reason why it isn't being covered.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to put to you. The silence on the health crisis in Fallujah fits with media's or corporate media's general presentation of the Iraq War as over, first of all, and then as successful, which, as we talked about with you the last time you were here, has kind of become the new definition of a victory. Now we talk about successful military operations. So this kind of is of a piece.
Yes, I think that's true. And in this case, success means withdrawal. So there's a kind of willful disbelief in the reality that the presence of U.S. forces will remain long into the future in Iraq. And so stories about the legacy of the war don't fit into that, in particular how the legacy of the war will impact the lives of everyday people in Iraq, not only in terms of lack of infrastructure, lack of jobs, lack of security, but also in terms of their long-term health and well-being.
We've been speaking with Hannah Gurman. Find her article, The Underexamined Story of Fallujah, on Foreign Policy in Focus's website, fpif.org. Thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.